Tom Sugrue est donc un historien qui enseigne actuellement à NYU, l'Université de New York. Il est originaire de Detroit, si je ne fais pas erreur. Et c'est peut-être pour ça qu'un de ses premiers livres a été sur ces villes, ces grandes villes industrielles américaines qui ont connu un déclin comme Detroit et qui ont été le lieu de tensions raciales. Donc là, il s'agissait d'un livre qu'il a écrit en 1996, The Origins of Urban Crisis. Voilà, donc ça, c'est les trois livres que Tom nous a suggéré de montrer. Le deuxième livre, Sweet Land of Liberty, c'est sur l'histoire des luttes pour les droits civiques, mais spécifiquement dans le nord des États-Unis. Et enfin, le troisième livre, Not Even Past, c'est le seul qui, je crois, a été traduit en français. Alors en anglais, enfin en américain, le sous-titre, c'est The Burden of Race, le poids de la race. Évidemment, sachant le fait qu'en France, il y a une certaine réticence pour utiliser ce mot de race, et on en parle assez dans ce séminaire, ça a été traduit par le poids du passé, qui est d'ailleurs un titre dont on pourrait éventuellement discuter. Donc voilà, et alors aujourd'hui, Tom va nous parler de l'histoire longue des luttes pour la justice raciale depuis le Red Summer au début du XXe siècle jusqu'à Black Lives Matter aujourd'hui. Merci. Dear Tom, we listen to you.
Merci, Régis. I will be speaking in English slowly, but my tendency as a New York-based American is to speak quickly. So please signal if I'm going too fast. I begin my talk this evening in 2020, a year that saw the largest and most extensive period of anti-racist protest in all of American history. By best estimates, somewhere between 15 and 25 million Americans took to the streets in the spring and summer of 2020 in several hundred cities, as well as suburbs and small towns, in thousands of protests, many of which were accompanied by uprisings, including clashes with the police, the looting and burning of stores, and the occupation of public buildings, parks, and other public squares in many American cities. And in the face of that, often very intense retaliatory police violence, as well as white vigilante violence in a number of cities, including Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Kenosha, Wisconsin, to mention just three.
Alors, donc, il va partir de l'année 2020, l'année qui vient de s'écouler, car c'est l'année la plus importante, la plus longue dans toute l'histoire des luttes pour la justice raciale aux États-Unis, avec entre 15 et 25 millions de personnes qui se sont exprimées dans les rues, dans des centaines de villes, des centaines de manifestations. Il y a eu des clashs, il y a eu des soulèvements, il y a eu des commerces brûlés, il y a eu aussi des violences policières, il y a eu aussi des violences blanches. Donc, le point de départ, c'est 2020.
The 2020 protests highlighted, most importantly, the hollowness of American claims that the civil rights movement has been fulfilled, that the United States is a colorblind society, and that racial inequalities are somehow a deviation from an American ideal of universal equal opportunity and race blindness. This was a rhetoric, of course, that was particularly powerful after the election of Barack Obama as our first African-American president in 2008, when many observers, both in the US and abroad, claimed that the United States had finally entered a post-racial or post-civil rights era, in the popular vernacular, the culmination of Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream.
Donc, cette année 2020, ce mouvement qui surgit, surgit alors que une idée était souvent présentée, le mouvement des droits civiques a été une réussite, nous sommes maintenant une société qui a cessé d'être sensible à la couleur de peau, les inégalités raciales, c'est simplement des dérives par rapport à l'idéologie, la vision que l'Amérique a maintenant d'elle-même. Enfin, il y avait une rhétorique très forte qui avait été liée à Obama et à l'idée qu'on était dans une époque post-raciale ou post-civil rights et qu'on était rentré donc dans une nouvelle ère. C'était ça une idée qui était très forte.
So when we look out onto the United States in 2020, we need, and I will for a moment, diagnose some of the racial inequalities that persist, as well as note some of the really significant changes that have taken place, largely as a result of prior social movements, which will be the subject of much of my talk this evening. But I want to begin by saying that there's a lot of racial pessimism in the United States right now, but we should note a number of areas of positive change. The United States is more diverse and at least superficially more tolerant than it was 50 years ago, even despite the resurgence of explicit racism during the presidency of Donald Trump. Americans have come to expect, for example, diversity in the top ranks of government and in corporations, in the media, on university faculties, and ethnic and racial diversity are prized among some of the most influential elites in the United States. In fact, the very nature of the 2020 protests is an indication of how much has changed in the United States. Past protests against racial injustice in the 20th century were led by African Americans. The vast majority of participants were African Americans. Whites were a small minority of participants. Most of those uprisings happened in African American communities. And the majority of whites were indifferent or hostile to the demands that protesters made. But in 2020, a majority of the Black Lives Matter protests in the United States, by best measure, were white, something unthinkable in 1968. Or 1941.
Alors, si on regarde ce qui s'est passé en 2020, donc ces protestations à propos des inégalités raciales, il faut voir aussi qu'il y avait eu un certain nombre de changements auparavant qui étaient liés à un certain nombre de mouvements, qu'il n'y avait pas simplement des choses qui rendaient pessimistes. Il y avait apparemment plus de diversité dans la société américaine, plus de tolérance, la diversité gagnait les différents sommets, les élites politiques, les élites institutionnelles, les élites, les enseignants, les médias. Bon. Et en fait, quand on y regarde de près, les protestations des années plus lointaines n'étaient pas des protestations où il y avait beaucoup de blancs. C'était en réalité essentiellement les communautés noires qui s'étaient mobilisées avant 2020. Une première chose très, très importante, en 2020, la majorité, alors que jusque-là, la majorité des Blancs étaient hostiles au mouvement noir, aux protestations noires, en 2020, majorité blanche de gens qui protestent. Là, c'est un terme. It's a white majority of people protesting in 2020.
Exactly. Enfin. So, the United States has long valued what I would call representational diversity or symbolic diversity. That is the performance of racial diversity by key institutions having black or brown faces. But that diversity belies a reality of still very deep racial inequalities in crucial areas of American life. Those include residential segregation, that is the lack of equal opportunity in housing. Most American metropolitan areas today are as racially segregated as they were 20 or 30 or 50 years ago. The trend line has been down, but rates of racial segregation between African Americans and whites remain very high. And that racial segregation in housing has a profound effect on racial segregation in education. America's educational system today in total is now majority non-white. That is, children, young people in the United States are majority non-white, but the vast majority of African Americans attend schools in districts that are 60% or greater African American. By contrast, most whites attend schools with hardly any African American students in them, or just a token number. So here we see two crucial examples of the ways in which racial separation and inequality persist.
Donc, il y a d'un côté de la diversité, de la présence symbolique ou parfois importante dans des institutions clés, mais cette diversité qu'on peut observer, cette diversité raciale qu'on peut observer, masque des très profondes inégalités et en donne deux domaines, dans tout ce qui touche au logement et donc la ségrégation dans l'espace, et comme conséquence, tout ce qui touche au système éducatif. La majorité des Noirs habitent dans des districts noirs et leurs enfants vont dans des écoles qui sont pour les Noirs, et les Blancs vont dans des écoles pour les Blancs. Et bien entendu, il y a d'énormes différences de niveau d'éducation.
The famous sociologist Charles Tilly coined the term durable inequalities to describe the persistence of differences in opportunity across time, durable, enduring. And we have to confront that in 2020, despite representational diversity, African Americans are at the bottom by nearly every measure in durable ways. For example, African American unemployment rates have remained 1.5 to 2 times those of whites since the 1950s, when the economy is good and when the economy is bad. As a consequence, African American household income, the best measure of what a household has to live on, has barely changed in nearly 50 years. In 1967, Black households earned 55% of the income of white households. In 2013, 59% of the income of white households.
Alors, Charles Tilly, l'historien sociologue qui est mort il y a quelques années, utilisait l'expression de inégalité durable, persistante, on devrait dire en français, je pense, pour rendre compte du fait que malgré plus de représentation, plus de présence, tout ce qui a été dit jusqu'ici, en réalité, les Noirs américains restent en bas, que le chômage est plus fort pour eux, et que ça n'a pratiquement pas changé, que le niveau de revenu par rapport au revenu des Blancs reste bas, ça ne s'est pas amélioré non plus.
And the consequences of that is that African-American poverty remains enduring. And despite all of the cultural emphasis in the United States on Black celebrities, corporate leaders, and elites, the share of African Americans in the top 20%, in the top 20% of income earners in the United States has barely changed since 1970, from 8% in 1970 to 9% in 2010. So we see, in other words, despite media-generated visions of African-American affluence in the United States, still enormous economic gaps.
Il demeure un fossé économique considérable, même si l'image que donnent les médias est celle de célébrités noires qui montreraient de la diversité au sommet. La réalité, c'est que ça n'a pas changé et c'est toujours... dans les inégalités persistent quand on regarde les revenus, par exemple, où les gens les 20% les plus riches, le nombre de Noirs n'a pratiquement pas changé en pourcentage, et toujours très inférieur à celui des Blancs.
In addition, the biggest gap between African Americans and whites is in household wealth. That is, in the assets that a household has. Those would include investments in the stock market or bank accounts. They might include vehicles or, for the very wealthy, jewelry and art. Most Americans get most of their wealth from their homes. African Americans have significantly lower rates of home ownership, and as a result, significantly lower rates of wealth. The average African American household in the United States has 10% of the household wealth of the average white household. One-tenth, 10%. That figure has fluctuated a little bit, but it's always remained high.
Donc, le plus spectaculaire dans toutes ces inégalités apparaît si on considère le patrimoine, qu'il s'agisse évidemment de la maison où l'on habite, ou des biens qu'on peut avoir, des actions, des belles voitures, etc. Les Noirs sont à 10% au niveau des Blancs. Donc là, c'est une inégalité considérable si on considère le patrimoine.
I could go on, but let me just list two other inequalities that are very pertinent to 2020. The criminal justice system. 6 in 10 prisoners in the United States are non-white, disproportionately African-American men. Black males are incarcerated at 6.5 times the rate of white males. And African-Americans are disproportionately represented among those who are killed by the police every year. About 1,100 Americans die of the police, die at the hands of the police, and the largest segment of that 1,100 who die are African American.
Dernier, enfin, autre exemple des injustices, tout ce qui touche au système carcéral et à la justice, les Noirs en prison sont 6.5 fois plus nombreux, toute proportion gardée, que les Blancs. Et les Noirs tués par la police, c'est des chiffres considérables. Ils donnent le chiffre de 1100 Noirs tués par la police en un an. That's it. 1,100 African Americans being killed by police. That's it.
So it should come as no surprise then that these inequalities shaped the direction of the 2020 protests, but also in ways that have not been commented on, also shape and limit the strategy and the ideology of those who protest. That is, the cities with the largest protests in the United States and the states with the most significant protests are also those with the highest rates of racial segregation in education and housing, and for the most part, the highest rates of economic inequality by any number of different metrics. It is, in other words, the large metropolitan areas of the North that are today most profoundly shaped by the long, durable inequalities of race in the United States.
Donc, on constate que le mouvement a été mis en forme, en quelque sorte, le mouvement de 2020 a été en quelque sorte mis en forme par toutes ces inégalités qui sont très, très claires. C'est dans les grandes métropoles du Nord, là où la ségrégation est la plus forte, là où l'accès au logement, l'accès à l'éducation est le plus difficile pour les Noirs américains, là où les inégalités sont les plus criantes, que ce mouvement a été le plus fort.
So when we look at the protesters in, say, my city, New York, in 2020, most of those protesters, despite their commitment to reforming or abolishing the police, despite their commitment to racial equality, and despite their participation in diverse protests, go home to racially segregated neighborhoods. They were educated in separate and unequal schools. And the whites among those protesters, even if they are now aware of, as they would call it, their white privilege, are still beneficiaries of a system of structural and institutional racism.
Donc il faut bien voir. It's difficult. So I must explain this. This is crucial. il faut bien voir que les manifestations, par exemple à New York, qui est la ville où il habite, c'est, il fallait bien voir que malgré des engagements pour les droits civils, contre le, pour réformer la police, pour lutter contre les inégalités, ce genre de choses, les personnes blanches d'une ville comme New York habitent des zones qui sont blanches, envoient leurs enfants ou vont eux-mêmes faire leurs études dans des écoles blanches. Ce sont des mondes blancs très, très protégés, je dirais, et très ségrégés.
D'accord. So, what I want to do over the remainder of my talk now, as a historian, historien sociologue, as you call, wonderfully call Charles Tilly, which is accurate, is to situate the 2020 protests in the longue durée, to trace back those protests and consider them in relationship to the 100 years of racial inequality and demands to change it in the United States, to think about commonalities and differences, but also to think about what we can learn from the successes as well as the limitations and failures of those past movements. The victories that are evident on the ground in 2020 and the inequalities that are evident on the ground in 2020 are both the consequence of the unfinished struggle for racial justice in America.
Donc, il va maintenant situer le mouvement de 2020 par rapport à tout ce qui s'est passé sur une centaine d'années. Donc, sur des luttes d'une centaine d'années, ça permettra de voir ce qu'il y a en commun et ce qu'il y a de différent. Ça permettra de tirer des leçons, des succès et des échecs de toutes ces luttes du passé.
So I'm going to begin with a series of generalizations of sort of a big picture about the trajectory of the freedom struggle in the period between 1919 and today. I'm going to focus especially on the high point of that movement between the 1930s and the 1960s. Some call this the classic period of civil rights in the United States.
Donc, il va d'abord se concentrer sur les années 1930-1960, ce qu'on peut appeler la période, l'époque classique, hein, des luttes pour les droits civils.
So first, most of the scholarship on civil rights, most of the representation of the history of the civil rights movement in textbooks, in films, in popular culture, in jurisprudence, focuses overwhelmingly on the American South. My first proposition is that the civil rights movement is a national movement, and the trajectory of that movement in the North, in major cities like New York and Chicago and Detroit, is essential for understanding the movement and its consequences today.
Donc le premier point sur lequel il veut insister, et tout ceci apparaît si on regarde les livres, les textbooks, les films, etc. Ce mouvement qui est un mouvement national, il faut d'abord le considérer dans les grandes métropoles du nord des États-Unis.
Many Americans and scholars, even superb scholars of social movements, see the American South as exceptional, as different because of its peculiar history of slavery and official racial segregation. But I want to show that the story of the 20th century United States is one of many, many commonalities between the regions, not differences.
Donc il va montrer que l'histoire est faite beaucoup plus de points communs que de différences dans l'histoire de toutes ces luttes.
Northerners and Americans generally perceive the area outside the South as a place of racial innocence. That is, as a place where there were not official laws, essentially apartheid laws, as there were in much of the South, that restricted where African Americans could go. No going to hotels, no using the same lavatories, no riding together on public transit, for example.
Alors, l'image qu'on a en général, c'est que la question de tout ce qui est apartheid, tout ce qui est hôtel séparé, toilettes séparées, transport, on s'assied chacun de son côté, etc., cette question était perçue comme, ça c'est le Sud, au Nord, il a utilisé l'expression « innocence raciale hein », c'est-à-dire que toutes ces questions ne concerneraient pas le Nord. C'est ça l'image générale qui prévalait.
Exactly. And so what we need to understand is that in most of the United States, whether it was by law or in custom and everyday practice, segregation by race was pervasive all the way through the 20th century. Schools were segregated by race, except for a very short period of time. Housing, as I mentioned earlier, was long segregated by race, beginning in the 1920s. And public accommodations, hotels, restaurants, swimming pools, and so forth in the North, as well as in the South, were segregated by race nearly completely through the middle of the 20th century.
Jusqu'au milieu du 20e siècle, contrairement donc à cette image de l'innocence par rapport au problème de la ségrégation, le Nord ségrégeait aussi les Noirs, qu'il s'agisse de l'école, qu'il s'agisse du logement, qu'il s'agisse de l'accès aux piscines. Il faut bien voir que la ségrégation régnait au Nord et pas seulement au Sud.
The vision of a civil rights, an anti-civil rights American, a white American, is a member of the Ku Klux Klan wearing his hood, or a southern redneck, as we call them, irrational, backwards racists who were a deviation from the American ideal. But the story of the African-American migration to the North shows that this is a complete misrepresentation of the nature of white racism in modern America. White racism was pervasive. One did not need to wear a hood, burn a cross, or watch a lynching to participate fully in the marginalization of non-whites.
Alors, il précise de cette idée, quand on parle des racistes américains, on pense en général aux gens du Ku Klux Klan, aux rednecks, les paysans du Sud, pas très intelligents, pas cultivés, enfin bref, des gens qui seraient des déviants par rapport au credo américain, au modèle américain. C'est faux. Il existait au Nord aussi, en réalité, des modalités de racistes, parce que le racisme, ce n'est pas simplement le lynchage et les horreurs du Ku Klux Klan au sud des États-Unis.
So when the first African Americans began to migrate to major cities in large numbers, when they began to move to places like New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit, they faced systematic white violence. For example, my talk begins with Chicago in the so-called Red Summer of 1919. When whites, middle and working class in Chicago brutally attacked African Americans who had just moved to their city, burned African American owned stores and businesses, and were supported in their violence by the city's nearly all white police force, who provided material support to white violent opposition to blacks.
Donc, le point de départ de tout ça, il y a eu un mouvement à partir du début du XXe siècle par lequel des Noirs ont migré vers le Nord pour aller travailler dans les grandes métropoles, New York, Chicago, Philadelphie, Detroit. Et là, ils se sont heurtés à des violences raciales, avec en particulier des Blancs, des couches moyennes, qui ont attaqué parfois très très violemment. Ils citent l'exemple de l'été rouge, le Red Summer de 1919 à Chicago, où des Blancs s'en sont pris extrêmement violemment aux Noirs, avec le soutien de la police. Ça a été extrêmement violent.
In my first book, which was about Detroit, I documented more than 200 violent attacks on the property or person of the first African Americans to move into the city's formerly all-white neighborhoods. those acts of violence were tolerated and sometimes encouraged by the police.
Donc, il donne l'exemple de son livre sur Détroit. 200, il évoque 200 attaques violentes contre des Noirs comme personne, contre leurs propriétés, contre leurs biens. Tout ça avec la tolérance et parfois même les encouragements de la police.
In addition, as the American historian at the Sorbonne, Andrew Diamond, has shown, street gangs, groups of young whites, regularly, militantly protected their neighborhood from African Americans, even from driving or walking through their neighborhoods, or going to parks that were in or near, or beaches that were in or near white neighborhoods.
Donc, des groupes de blancs, des gangs, des gangs de rue, aussi blancs, jouent un rôle aussi dans ces violences, y compris pour empêcher les Noirs d'aller se baigner sur les plages de la ville, par exemple.
So, in looking at the North, then, we need to understand the ways in which racial violence racial violence with the support of the police shaped the consciousness of African American activists who saw ordinary white resistance, ordinary white opposition, the opposition of the police, of law enforcement officials, of government as connected, as intertwined. That sets the background, one of the key elements of the background for what happens in 2020.
Si on veut voir le fond de ce qui s'est passé en 2020, il faut bien voir que dès cette époque, un siècle plus tôt, la violence raciale, c'est une violence qui se fait, qui va forger la conscience noire. C'est une violence de blancs qui vise les noirs avec le soutien ou la connexion. La police est connectée à cette violence. Le rôle de la police est crucial.
Racial violence and violent policing is only one part of the story of racial inequality and its origins and its perpetuation in the North. Another is the role of institutions, particularly major economic institutions like real estate brokers and banks, and of course, government at all levels, the federal government, state governments, and local governments, which enacted policies that were either explicitly racist or which had negative effects on people of color, of non-whites, even if their intentions were not racist.
Donc, premier volet du problème, c'est donc ce qui est de l'ordre de la violence proprement des Blancs et surtout de la police. Deuxième volet, c'est le rôle des institutions qui vont elles aussi contribuer à mettre en forme le racisme, en particulier les grandes institutions économiques, les banques, tout ce qui touche la propriété immobilière, mais aussi les gouvernements. Aux États-Unis, vous avez le gouvernement fédéral, vous avez le gouvernement des États, et vous avez des gouvernements locaux avec des policiers extrêmement racistes, explicitement racistes. Donc tout ça va exercer aussi un effet très très fort sur la conscience noire, si je peux dire, de ces problèmes.
The most important role for the federal government and for state and local governments even more was creating and maintaining racial segregation in housing and education, two of the most durable of the racial inequalities of the United States.
Alors, le rôle le plus important de ce point de vue-là, de toutes les instances gouvernementales, fédérales, nationales, locales, c'est créer et maintenir la ségrégation dans l'habitat et dans l'éducation. C'est la chose la plus cruciale.
So when we think about racism in the United States, it's important to remember, especially important in this case, to remember that racial inequality it takes institutional form. It's shaped by public policy and institutions proved to be very resistant to change over time. And this was one of the hard lessons that civil rights activists learned again and again over the course of the 20th century.
Donc, une leçon très, très importante, c'est que toutes ces inégalités ne se comprennent pas, raciales, ne se comprennent pas si on ne voit pas qu'elles sont institutionnalisées, qu'elles se mettent en forme depuis des institutions qui ont une très grande capacité de résister au changement.
The one final area where there was persistent inequality that remained throughout the 20th century and into the 21st was in employment. Systematic discrimination in the workplace against African Americans, both in hiring and promotion, limited economic opportunities, and in addition, corporate policies about where to locate factories, offices, and retail all negatively impacted African Americans. That is, corporate policies led to the movement of jobs and opportunity to predominantly white areas in the suburbs and in rural America, away from the cities that were home to a significant segment of the African American population.
Alors, un autre domaine où va persister tout au long de cette période l'injustice et les inégalités raciales, c'est tout ce qui touche à l'emploi et au travail. Et donc là, les entreprises, qu'il s'agisse de l'embauche, qu'il s'agisse des promotions, ou qu'il s'agisse surtout de la localisation des usines, des commerces, etc., vont agir de façon à ce que la ségrégation continue en faveur des Blancs.
So, in thinking about how activists responded to these inequalities, they followed a couple of different paths. And I want to talk about those paths because they're very important for understanding where we are today. The first of those paths, was efforts to cast racial inequality as a moral problem and to try to solve it by changing the hearts and minds of white Americans. This could be done through religious activism, for example, through churches, and it could be done through increasing the representation of non-whites in key arenas of life so that whites would see them there, see an African American in a public-facing job or on a television show, and realize that the differences were not nearly as important as the similarities. The vernacular for this was, we're all just alike beneath the skin.
Alors, comment répondre à tout ça? Quelles ont été les différentes voies explorées pour répondre à toutes ces injustices, inégalités? Premier chemin suivi, des efforts pour faire de ces inégalités un problème de type moral, c'est-à-dire modifier l'état d'esprit des Blancs, par exemple dans la religion, dans les églises, accroître la visibilité, la présence de Noirs dans un certain nombre d'endroits, montrer que finalement la couleur de peau ne devait pas peser sur la façon dont vivent les gens. Donc premièrement, pression morale.
This effort to change the hearts and minds of white Americans was arguably the most successful element of civil rights in the 20th century. In 1943, about two-thirds of Americans in the North, about two-thirds said that they would not accept having even a single African-American neighbor or a single African-American child in school with their children. Just 20 years later, by 1963, nearly 70% of Northern whites said that they were fine with the idea of having an African-American neighbor or sending their children to school where there were other African-American children. Attitudes, at least in terms of what people were willing to tell survey researchers, changed as a result of this campaign.
Alors, ces efforts ont eu des résultats ils ont été très, très réussis. En 1943, deux tiers des Américains disaient qu'ils n'accepteraient pas, des Blancs américains disaient qu'ils n'accepteraient pas d'avoir un seul voisin noir ou un seul enfant noir dans l'école de leurs enfants. 10 ans plus tard, ils sont 70% à dire que ce n'est pas un problème, à accepter cette hypothèse.
This campaign trying to transform individual whites has its legacies right up until the present day, particularly in calls for diversity, in expanding the representation of African Americans, and in what now is called problematically cancel culture or political correctness, that is, in efforts to try to stamp out language that is racially offensive or that causes psychic or emotional damage to those who hear it. This is the legacy of that thread of the civil rights struggle of the 20th century, and it's important in 2020.
Le legs historique de cette pression morale, c'est le fait qu'aujourd'hui, on entend beaucoup de Blancs accepter l'idée de diversité, l'idée qu'il et même ce qu'on appelle la cancel culture, c'est-à-dire l'idée qu'il faut expulser de la culture tout ce qui peut être offensant pour les Noirs. Cette idée est très, très répandue. Donc ça, c'est le legs de cette dimension morale du combat depuis les années 1930 ou 40.
This is the part of the civil rights movement in its history that continues to be celebrated in popular culture. Martin Luther King Jr. is not a socialist, a labor organizer, and a critic of American imperialism. He is the leader who tells white Americans that they need to love each other and does it softly and reasonably in the eyes of American popular culture.
Donc tout ça reste dans la culture. Quand Martin Luther King dit qu'il faut s'aimer tous les Américains, il incarne cet héritage.
This strand of civil rights, however influential, leaves out the part that was the core of the African American freedom struggle, and that is efforts to change political and economic structures and institutions that were the primary cause of racial inequality in the United States. The problem wasn't primarily white people thinking badly of black people. It was that a whole set of political and economic institutions in place, some for racially problematic reasons, others for colorblind or race neutral reasons, negatively impacted the lives of millions of non-whites in the United States.
Donc, ce qui avait été évoqué jusqu'ici, le côté moral est une chose. L'autre côté, c'est qu'au cœur des luttes des Noirs américains, il y avait l'idée qu'il fallait modifier les structures mêmes qui fabriquent ces injustices et qui sont des structures politiques, économiques et institutionnelles. C'était vraiment le cœur du problème, les institutions. J'en parlais. Non, c'est ce qu'on va appeler en France le racisme institutionnel.
Oui. So, institutional racism, le racisme institutionnel in the United States became the primary focus of African Americans fighting for racial equality between the 1920s and the 1960s. And let me just lay out briefly the ways in which they challenged institutional racism. First, we often draw, and this is true, I think, in France as well in the United States, a binary distinction between race and class, as if one somehow wins out over the other, or if the two are incompatible with each other. But civil rights activists in the United States saw race and class, racial inequality and economic inequality, as fundamentally connected. The two needed to be solved at once if there was to be true racial justice in the United States.
Alors, le premier point, c'est la question de savoir comment gérer la distinction, le binôme classe-race, le côté social et le côté racial. Et donc, est-ce que c'est incompatible, est-ce que c'est l'un ou est-ce que c'est l'autre? Ce qui est très clair, c'est qu'aux États-Unis, le mouvement noir a considéré que les inégalités raciales et les inégalités économiques formaient un tout. Ça forme un tout, on ne peut pas les séparer. C'est un point extrêmement... Elles sont absolument liées. You cannot distinguish between racial and social inequalities. It's
exactly.
It's a system. It's a rule. It's a rule.
Exactly.
But it does not mean that it is the same.
Exactly. They saw them as connected and made a case that each needed to be addressed simultaneously, that one couldn't deal with racial inequality in the United States without simultaneously dealing with economic inequality. Or, as many civil rights activists in northern cities and nationally, including King, Martin Luther King, argued that full employment has to go along with fair employment. Full employment meaning an economy that creates many jobs and opportunity for working class and poorer Americans. Fair employment means that those jobs are not maldistributed by race, that they don't go towards whites and not to African Americans. They argued that you needed both at once.
Donc, pour illustrer ce point qui veut qu'on ne peut pas séparer la question de la race et la question de la classe, pour le dire comme ça, il y a ce que disait Martin Luther King à propos de l'emploi. L'emploi doit être full, tout le monde doit y accéder, tout le monde, et il doit être fair, c'est-à-dire que tout le monde doit y accéder de la même manière, il doit être distribué de façon équitable.
Similarly, when it came to housing, some activists argued that housing integration would happen when whites changed their minds, but many by the 1950s and 1960s argued that the United States needed to put into place public policies that transformed the real estate market and the mortgage market as a way of opening up opportunities for African Americans in housing markets across the United States.
Sur la question du logement maintenant, là aussi certains pensaient qu'il suffirait que les Blancs changent d'avis, le côté moral qu'on a évoqué tout à l'heure. En fait, dans les années 50 et 60, l'idée qui s'est développée, c'est qu'il faut des politiques publiques qui pèsent sur le marché immobilier, sur la capacité et qui transforment le marché immobilier de façon à ce que les Noirs puissent accéder aussi au logement dans des conditions convenables.
One of the biggest problems in the United States is, and I'll borrow another phrase from the historian sociologist Charles Tilly. I've been reading him for one of my classes lately. Tilly talks about opportunity hoarding. That is groups that have economic power or resources or opportunity tend to hoard those resources, tend to hoard those opportunities, and in the process, accumulate advantages. And this was the case, even if activists didn't use Charles Tilly's words, he wasn't a key figure in the movement, it was basically the framework that they deployed to understand racial inequality in housing and education, which is whites hoarded the advantages of education and public goods in separate communities, mostly in the post-war period in all white suburbs.
Alors, j'ai pas bien compris comment traduire en français l'expression de Charles Tilly, c'est le conserver le monopole en quelque sorte des ressources. Hein, c'est un peu, je crois que c'est ça l'idée. C'est-à-dire que les blancs qui ont l'accès à des opportunités, à des avantages, eh bien, les veulent pour eux et pour eux seulement, les gèrent ensemble.
Michel, je pense que le bon mot c'est accaparer.
Accaparer les ressources.
Oh, okay.
That's a good word for me to learn. Thank you. This is, I should say, just as an aside, this is a wonderful way for me to practice my my French, because I can understand it well when it's spoken to me, but I can't speak it worth anything. So so thank you for these useful translations. So civil rights activists, in other words, at their strongest, at their most militant, demanded changes in the sorts of political institutions that maintained segregation. They called especially for the lowering of boundaries, geographic and juridical or political boundaries that reinforced racial difference. And let me be very clear about this. These boundaries are the boundaries of municipality in the United States, of local government. Unlike in France, where localities matter, but not nearly as much in the United States, education is provided locally. Social services are provided by local governments and institutions. Highways and infrastructure are determined by states and local governments. And as a result, there can be enormous differences between one place and the next, another place, even if a very simple municipal or jurisdictional boundary separates them.
Donc, un des gros problèmes sur lequel les militants de cette époque se sont mobilisés, c'était les frontières. Les frontières qui font que des municipalités ou des parties de villes s'accaparent, je reprends l'expression de Charles Tilly, hein, s'accaparent les ressources et que dans la municipalité d'à côté, c'est une catastrophe parce qu'il n'y a pas de ressources. Donc les Noirs dans les endroits où il n'y a pas de ressources et les Blancs monopolisent en quelque sorte les ressources.
So,
la question, c'est les frontières, la capacité de maintenir des frontières très puissantes.
So, in effect, they recognize that to change racial inequality in the United States meant going after key political institutions and going after the very organization of the American economy. In other words, if racism was institutional in origin, the solutions needed to be institutional as well.
Donc la conclusion de tout ça, c'est puisque le racisme est dans les institutions, qu'il est institutionnel, la solution doit être également d'ordre institutionnel.
So this leads me to one final point about the wave of protests in the 20th century, particularly in the 1960s, but also even in earlier periods. To change politics in institutions is very difficult in the United States. It's difficult everywhere. Civil rights activists tried a variety of different strategies, picketing and protesting, filing lawsuits in courts, putting pressure on legislatures to pass laws. But ultimately, they found one tool was particularly effective in getting the attention of policymakers and economic institutions. That tool was disruption or the threat of disruption.
Alors, les militants dans les années 60 s'aperçoivent qu'il est très difficile de changer la politique, de changer les institutions. On peut faire beaucoup de choses, on peut aller devant la justice, on peut demander des lois, on peut faire des protestations, on peut faire des piquets, etc. Mais en réalité, ils ont compris que la meilleure façon d'être efficace, il y a un outil qui est peut-être plus efficace que n'importe quel autre, c'est ce qu'il appelle la disruption, j'ai envie de dire, ou la menace de la disruption, c'est-à-dire la violence. Enfin, you mean violence or not only by disruption?
I mean large mass protests and violence or the threat of violence. It didn't always take violence. It could be the prospect of a violent eruption that was enough to...
Donc, protestation de masse et ou bien la violence, ou bien faire planer la menace de la violence. Un jouet sur la menace de la violence. C'est ça qui peut avoir le plus d'effet.
So just to give you a few specific examples, the Kennedy and Johnson administrations did not move towards national civil rights laws until there were mass protests, and especially in the period between 1963 and 1968, violence and the threat of violence and militancy in cities all over the United States. They were very explicit. They saw civil rights as a way of managing disorder or preventing disorder.
Donc, l'exemple le plus évident, c'est que les administrations Kennedy puis Johnson n'ont bougé que quand il y a eu des mouvements de masse et des violences ou des menaces de violence. Ils ont pris des mesures parce qu'il y avait ces mouvements et ces violences.
Local governments also responded to the threat of disruption, particularly local economic and civic elites who feared that race conflict or disruption would damage their investments and hurt them financially.
Et par exemple, localement aussi, la hantise de la violence est une hantise qui, en particulier, peut être économique. Ça perturbe le travail, ça perturbe la vie économique, donc ça fait bouger les choses.
The biggest gains in the 1960s came in the public sector. That is one way of, as it was put in the colloquial in the 1960s, buying riot insurance, that is preventing uprisings or riots, was to hire growing numbers of African Americans, particularly in public sector jobs. That's had long-term consequences. The public sector is the most important employment sector for African Americans in the United States today as a consequence of the social movements of the 1960s.
Donc, une des réponses à cette hantise de l'émeute, ça a été de donner des emplois aux Noirs américains. Et qu'est-ce qui les a donnés? C'est le secteur public. Ce qui fait que c'est dans le secteur public qu'il y a le plus de Noirs au travail aujourd'hui aux États-Unis.
But disruption or violence and the threat of disruption or violence had many unexpected or unanticipated consequences. Let me just lay out a few. One was the intensification of white resistance to African Americans, particularly by law enforcement, who used protests and uprisings to justify the militarization of the police and public officials used the uprisings to justify the expansion of America's prison system and policing. It laid the groundwork for the crisis of 2020.
Alors, le fait que cette menace, cette réalité de la disruption, hein, de la violence qui surgit, c'est que ça va donc avoir des conséquences inattendues. Et parmi ces conséquences inattendues, toutes celles qui vont peser, qui vont prendre la forme de résistance aux blancs à ces menaces, et en particulier la police et le système carcéral. On va militariser la police, elle va être beaucoup, on va la rendre beaucoup plus répressive en quelque sorte, et expansion du système carcéral dont il avait parlé au tout début.
As a related point, protests and uprisings in the 1960s gave rise to what I will call an unacknowledged or unacknowledged white identity politics. That is a white politics that emphasized the universality of white understandings of politics and marginalized or represented as particular African American and other minority group politics.
Just a parenthesis, it's exactly what we are having now in France in the intellectual sphere.
Exactly. I am well aware.
Donc, c'est très intéressant. Cette protestation va faire aussi se crisper en quelque sorte certains blancs et ça va déboucher sur des white politics, des politiques identitaires blanches dans lesquelles on se dit blanc, on se présente comme universel alors qu'en réalité on représente une identité blanche qui marginalise les autres.
And I should just add as a parenthesis that this white identity politics, of course, gives rise to the new right from Richard Nixon to Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump. But it also has very strong support, particularly among centrists in the Democratic Party, who argue that their party's future relies on maintaining the loyalty of whites who are angry at what they saw as excessive Black demands.
Et donc ça va avoir un effet politique, par exemple, jusque parmi les centristes, le côté centriste des démocrates, l'idée qu'il faut quand même faire attention à ne pas mettre en cause la loyauté dont les blancs ont besoin. Et donc il faut maintenir une loyauté pour les blancs et ne pas donc laisser aller les choses en faveur des autres minorités.
Third, I would make a case that the post-Second World War II thread of civil rights, that is the emphasis on changing whites' hearts and minds, enjoyed a revival because of the growing importance of individualistic explanations of racial inequality over institutional. One of, you could say, the side effects of neoliberalism in the post-1970s period.
Un dernier aspect qu'il veut évoquer, c'est que l'idée de changer la morale, qui était la première voie qui avait été explorée, ça a accompagné une sorte de renaissance ou de renforcement des explications individuelles, c'est-à-dire des explications qui ne s'intéressent pas à la dimension institutionnelle des problèmes. Et donc tout ce qui est allé avec cet individualisme a pu aussi faire partie du problème.
Voilà. That brings us back finally, and I'll stop here, to 2020. And the relationship of 2020 to the past. You can see that there are important currents of the civil rights movement in the mid-20th century, particularly its emphasis on the connections between race and class and the need to make institutional change that we see in elements of the 2020 protests. But we also see in those 2020 protests an emphasis on hearts and minds, on symbols and representation, and in the case especially of the white elites and corporations that have embraced the rhetoric Black Lives Matter, an attempt to flatten those major institutional demands to a consumer good or to a catchy slogan to perform racial equality. To understand 2020 requires us to look back at what we can take from the examples of the Black freedom struggle or the civil rights protests of the 20th century, but also what parts of it to be skeptical of. And so I'll stop with that comment.
Bon, et donc la question finale, c'est qu'est-ce qui est de l'ordre de la continuité et qu'est-ce qui est de l'ordre d'autre chose dans les émeutes de 2020 par rapport à ce qu'il y a dans le passé. Ce qui est de l'ordre de la continuité, c'est un, l'enjeu qui se joue autour de la dualité race et classe, les deux en même temps, premièrement. Deuxièmement, la question des institutions, mais en même temps, I'm sorry, I did not understood the last point, which is not the race and the racial and social dimensions, not the institutional dimensions, but the other dimensions, if you could say it again or differently.
Yes. My final point would be that we don't know what direction the racial struggle will go after 2020. Mm. But for it to succeed, it needs to take the most successful elements of the past 100 years and to be skeptical of the elements that did not work. That's the question that we have to answer going forward.
OK. Et donc, le point important, c'est si on veut imaginer la réussite à venir de ces luttes, il faut vraiment voir ce qui a marché et ce qui n'a pas marché dans le passé pour comment dirais-je, préparer les luttes à venir. OK. Well, Tom, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the translation.
I did my best. It's not my job, so I do it as I can. So we have less than half an hour to introduce questions so I will just start with one question so that after that the seminar can intervene more. I will just organize the debate. There is just one point I would like to clarify with you. The French image of civil rights movement is that it was a movement where Jews were very important, whilst today Jews have nothing to do until maybe the last movement. So could you say a few words about the relationship between Jews and Black or African-American during this last 60 or 50 years and today?
Yes. Excellent point. There were some white allies to the civil rights struggle, even if, as I said before, it's important to remember that the civil rights struggle was led by, organized by, and dominated by white Americans, by Black Americans. Mm. But Jews played an important role, particularly institutionally. That is, many Jewish organizations had been founded to counter anti-Semitism and saw obvious parallels between their struggle to fight anti-Semitism and the struggle to fight racial prejudice and inequality in the United States. And so they often joined in support. And in many civil rights marches, north and south, from the 1920s to the 1960s, had a prominent Jewish presence. That said, a majority of American Jews, like a majority of American whites, were indifferent, were on the sidelines. One other element of the Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement, which used to be controversial, and now I think it's not, among scholars at least, is that Jews were overrepresented on the American left. And the most vocal white supporters of the African-American equality were communists, socialists, and members of the left wing of the Democratic Party. They were the whites who were most likely to show up at protests, most likely to contribute money, most likely to demonstrate and litigate. And so Jews were well represented in part because they were very well represented on the American left.
OK. Donc, l'évolution, c'est qu'à l'époque, dans les années 50-60, les Juifs étaient très présents à l'aile gauche hein, du Parti démocrate. Et soutenait le mouvement. C'était la réponse à ma question. So now the seminar can go on and can. So when you want to talk, it's you, Régis, that will organize the discussion.
Yes, and peut-être d'abord Philippe Portier. Maybe Philippe can ask. I don't know if you have any question, Philippe. Or
yes, thank you very much, Régis. Yes, two or three questions. The first one is about the differences between, thank you very much for this fascinating lecture. My first question is about the specificity, the singularity of the policy of Obama. Does it change the policy of racism, the policy of race in America, or was it only sort of discourse without any effect on the reality? That's my first question. My second one is about the police. We saw in your lecture that the police, even today, is very brutal, very violent. In the program of education of the policemen, are the things changing in United States? Do you see some evolution in the way of the formation of policemen? That's my second question. And my third one is about the voters for Trump. What are their opinion? Because they are about 80 million in the American populations. What are the attitudes of these voters toward racism? Could you see some different segments, some different parts in this electorate, or do you think that this electorate is really racist in its opinions?
Philippe, peut-être peux-tu résumer tes trois questions en une phrase pour que tout le monde...
Oui. Alors, la première question portait sur la politique d'Obama. Est-ce que la politique d'Obama est une politique qui dépasse simplement le speech act, le fait de parler? Est-ce qu'il y a un effet sur la réalité? La deuxième question portait sur les programmes de formation des policiers. Est-ce que les... Étant donné ce que vous nous avez dit, est-ce qu'il y a une évolution dans les programmes de formation des policiers, ce qui jouerait sur le versant institutionnel que vous avez présenté? Puis le troisième point, c'est de savoir s'il y a des segments à l'intérieur de l'électorat de Trump. Il y a 76 millions de personnes, je crois, qui ont voté pour Trump. Est-ce qu'ils sont uniformes dans leur appréciation des questions relatives au racisme?
To the first question and the third question together, because they're related, Obama ended up being very cautious on the question of race and talked about it very little through his presidency, in large part because he perceived that this would be a divisive issue to raise, and indeed it proved to be so. Anytime Obama mentioned a racial matter, it became a national controversy almost immediately, even when he said very uncontroversial, common sense things like during the campaign, I don't look like other people on the dollar bills, became a huge controversy because Obama mentioned race. Obama unleashed white animosity in ways that nobody had anticipated in 2008 when he was elected. And that animosity was one factor, not the sole factor, but one factor in mobilizing voters for Donald Trump, who pledged to restore America to a period of greatness, which many perceived as a period of low immigration, of African Americans knowing their place, and of caution on the question of race and civil rights. But even those Republicans, even most of them, hardcore Trump supporters and Trump himself will make pledges that they're not racist. I have black friends is a very common, I don't hold any racist beliefs in my heart, even if the America that they envisioned was one that was deeply racist at core. On the police, very quickly, there have been reforms in police around questions of race and racial sensitivity since the 1960s, and they have largely failed. In great part because they happen episodically and they don't fundamentally transform the culture of policing, which includes still deeply entrenched fears of African-American menace.
Okay, je résume en une demi-phrase qui vient d'être dit. Un, en ce qui concerne Obama, il a été très prudent parce que dès qu'il touchait à ces questions, ça suscitait des controverses. Il suffisait qu'ils disent qu'ils n'avaient pas tout à fait la même tête que les autres présidents qu'on voit sur les billets de banque pour susciter une énorme controverse. Donc, il savait qu'il y avait beaucoup d'animosité. Il a découvert ça. C'est ce qui a fabriqué Trump, en réalité. Donc, il a été très, très prudent sur ces questions-là. Et en ce qui concerne la police, en gros, il y a eu beaucoup de tentatives de réforme et ça a toujours échoué.
OK. Alors, je vais passer la parole aux gens qui désirent poser une question. Mais auparavant, je voudrais moi-même poser une question à Tom. Tom, I would like to ask you to be a little more specific about one point that I didn't get totally. You were talking about the moral legacy from the civil rights movement. And specifically about the terms, the expressions of cancel culture and political correctness. And so how do you connect that? Because in my, I thought that these two words were in fact coming from the alt-right, Donald Trump used that term of cancel culture. Political correctness was, if I'm not mistaken, it comes from the Tea Party. So it's a vocabulary that is coming from the far right. So how do you connect that to this moral legacy from the civil rights movement?
Une phrase en français, ta question, Régis?
Oui, ce que je n'ai pas bien compris, et donc je demandais à Tom de préciser un peu plus, il parlait de l'héritage moral de ce mouvement des droits civiques, et en disant que ça avait eu un effet sur l'opinion publique, un effet différé, qui aboutissait à ces expressions de « cancel culture » et de « politiquement correct ». Et alors que moi, j'avais l'impression que c'était une sorte de réaction qui venait de l'extrême droite, de l'alt-right, qui a été utilisée notamment par Donald Trump. Et en plus, ça nous intéresse spécifiquement en France, puisque c'est maintenant un vocabulaire qui a été importé et qu'on retrouve vraiment dans chez un certain nombre d'éditocrates aujourd'hui en France, qui abusent, à mon avis, de ces termes-là.
Tom.
Yes, excellent question. I should begin by saying that I do not endorse either term cancel culture or political correctness for the reasons that you explain, although I should say that it's not just the right, but it's many centrists, including centrist Democrats, who argue that this emphasis on policing language, which is what is at the core of what the right calls cancel culture or political correctness, that these efforts to police language threaten free speech and reduce complex ideas to slogans. So there's a growing backlash against the language policing on the part of many centrists now. A group of major American academics, some on the right, but many in the center and even some on the left, wrote a public letter denouncing cancel culture a few months back in summer of 2020, which was very controversial. Let me say this, though. The commonality with this moral framework is the notion that the primary battleground for accomplishing racial justice in America is changing discourse or changing or modifying language. This was the primary goal of those who wanted to change hearts and minds. If you purify whites into not expressing racist sentiments publicly, then the argument went, prejudice would fall and racial transformation would follow. And what I'm saying is that, of course, like most intellectuals in the United States, I believe that we should be careful with the language that we use and shouldn't use divisive and racist rhetoric. But I don't follow, based on my emphasis on institutional racism, the argument that changing discourse is going to change practice. Changing discourse is not going to change institutions. It's not going to change economic structures. It's necessary, but far, far from sufficient, as we saw in the middle of the 20th century.
Donc, l'essentiel de la réponse, de ce discours qui n'est pas seulement de la droite aux États-Unis, qui est aussi au centre, y compris chez certains démocrates, l'idée c'était que, au départ, à l'époque du mouvement pour les droits civils, au départ, c'était l'idée qu'on va changer le discours, qu'on va expulser du discours, du vocabulaire, les mots qui renvoient au racisme. Et donc, à partir de là, l'idée, c'était si les gens n'ont plus le vocabulaire de mots ou d'expressions racistes, alors le racisme, les préjugés vont se réduire. Mais évidemment, conclut Tom, c'est pas parce qu'on fait ça, changer le discours ne change pas les institutions.
Thank you. This is very interesting. I will now maybe ask the two people that wrote an English question, so they can ask their own question. And c'est notamment Daniel Joly, si tu veux peut-être poser ta question directement à Tom.
I have two questions, but in the first instance, I want to say I'm part of a team of sociologists, anthropologists who are translating Black Metropolis. So what you said today made total sense. It was wonderful. I have one question which relates to France, but to what extent do you think that it's possible to talk about the heritage of the construction of Black consciousness in comparing it in France, mutatis mutandis, with the heritage of colonialism, colonization and decolonization, with regard to population of immigrant background who were former colonized populations? It's controversial, but I would love your comments on it. The second one is related. It's part of the institutional issue, which you have developed largely. Of course, there's been a huge theoretical debate about institutional structural racism. But it seems that the civil rights movement have nailed it by attacking it directly. In France at the moment, this is certainly denied by public discourse, by politicians, by media, in particular with regards to the police. There's no structural racism or institutional racism or any sort of generalized racism in the police. This is official racism. And I would like you to develop on it and how it has been brought to a recognition in the United States. It wasn't always recognized as such. I'm trying to develop, you know, the French situation and try and enrich our understanding.
Daniel, tu peux le dire en français?
Ah oui, 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 bien sûr. Je vais le dire en français. Oui, j'ai posé deux questions. Comment?
Tu résumes, tu condenses.
Ah bien sûr, j'ai posé deux questions. Une question, c'est dans quelle mesure peut-on dresser un parallèle sur l'héritage historique de la construction de la conscience noire aux États-Unis avec la construction de la conscience des populations d'origine immigrée qui étaient autrefois colonisées par le truchement de l'héritage colonial. La deuxième question, c'est une question sur le racisme institutionnel qui en France n'est pas reconnu comme tel certainement dans les hautes sphères politiques et dans les médias, et dans quelle mesure Tom peut nous expliquer un peu davantage comment cette reconnaissance aux États-Unis s'était développée et avait...
Tom.
These are excellent questions. I will answer the colonialism question very quickly in three ways. First, civil rights activists in the middle of the 20th century saw the Black freedom struggle in the United States as part of the anti-colonial struggle globally. They saw, sometimes problematically, but they saw African Americans as an internal colony of the United States and drew analogies between their struggle against white America with the struggles of Congo, of Indonesia, of various European colonies over time. And this international consciousness was very deep. I can talk about it for an hour, but I won't. Secondly, historians and scholars today have put a lot of emphasis on connections between colonialism, both colonialism in the French sense and colonialism in the American sense, which aren't entirely the same, of course, and racial injustice in the United States. One very explicit way that gets to your policing question is there's very good work by a young scholar named Stuart Schrader, who looks at connections between counterinsurgency policies of the United States in the Third World during the Cold War, and the use of those same strategies in the United States by the police during the 1960s and beyond. So the American police are learning from how America's counterinsurgencies are putting down uprisings in Africa and Latin America.
Donc, il a beaucoup insisté sur le lien à l'époque des années 50 entre le mouvement américain et l'idée que ce qui se passait aux États-Unis, c'était une sorte de colonialisme interne et qu'il y avait des luttes très parallèles, en quelque sorte, au Congo, en Indonésie ou ailleurs. Donc, c'était l'idée quand même que c'était une conscience mondiale, même si l'action était américaine. C'est surtout ça qu'il a répondu. Ensuite, il a parlé d'un ouvrage, je n'ai pas entendu le nom de l'auteur, Stuart Rader.
Stuart Schrader, il me semble.
Une dernière question, je crois, parce qu'il va falloir se séparer.
Alors, il y avait Dennis Guns qui posait une question intéressante en anglais, et puis peut-être une toute dernière aussi de Nelson Valero Gomez.
Ok, on prend les deux questions l'une derrière l'autre. We take the last two questions, one after the other one, and you have the last word. Ok, Tom?
Perfect.
Okay, thank you very much for your lecture. I have a very brief question. How do you explain the massive presence and participation of white Americans in 2020 protests? Do you think there has been some kind of evolution since the beginning of Black Lives Matter movement? Because I guess it has started 5-6 years ago. And how do the alliances between Black and non-Black activists work today? Are there any connections between Occupy Wall Street and a Capitol Hill movement and new precarious, black collars and Black Lives Matter activists? Thank you very much.
And Nelson?
Alors Nelson demande, il a posé plusieurs questions. Peut-être, si on doit faire vite, la dernière question, c'était à propos du multiculturalisme. So the question is, do you think that the the policy of multiculturalism is a failure in the USA, and or is there something that can be used as a model for the rest of the world in this topic?
Excellent questions, both. So let me begin with the question about the white protesters in 2020. And I'll begin my answer by saying there's still a lot of work to be done by sociologists to interview and gather data on the participants. And so my comments are based on anecdote and personal observation rather than systematic scholarly study. But let me say this. Most of the protesters in the United States were young, and most of them came of age in the precarious post-2008 United States. Next, many of them are highly educated, and they've come from colleges and universities where questions of intersectionality, of the intersections between race and gender, have shaped their curricula, and where many have been increasingly drawn toward oppositional politics, particularly socialism, which is gaining a real foothold among younger people in the United States. Many of those activists were shaped by their experiences with the Occupy movement, and especially with Black Lives Matter. And so all of those, I think, have come together to create a certain consciousness around racial and economic issues among a key segment of the younger population. So that's, I think we can only understand the 2020 protests in the context of what's happened since 2008, I think, in terms of white participation. Younger people also live in a more racially fluid world and a more everything fluid world, a more gender fluid world, a more sexuality fluid world in the United States. And I think that shapes their consciousness. That said, what kinds of alliances emerge between African-American and white protesters is very much an open question. Many white protesters are fearful that they're exercising their privilege, as they would put it, and try not to exercise leadership roles. Many African-Americans in the Black Lives Matter movement see whites as fickle, they come and go. And so whether or not this leads to a genuinely multiracial alliance after 2020 is an open question. I don't think it's resolved yet. In fact, what happens to the energy generated by 2020 is an open question. Will it result in the creation of a new movement or movements? Or did it happen and did it fade away quickly? We don't know that yet, and we can't predict. So that's question number one. Question number two, multiculturalism in the US, it's a very big question. I think it has shaped the consciousness of younger people in ways that relate to the previous question. But the emphasis on multiculturalism in the United States is, especially in education, especially in primary and secondary education, is very, very superficial. And it seldom deals with questions of inequality and power differentials. And so multiculturalism is not a solution, but it can at least change the consciousness of people who see the possibility, younger people especially, who see the possibility of building ties and forging alliances where that would have been unthinkable 50 years ago. And so it has that benefit, but largely multiculturalism lacks a structural, institutional, or political economic analysis.
Donc, I summarize, je résume pourquoi des Blancs si nombreux dans le mouvement de 2020. Il y a encore beaucoup de travail pour les sociologues parce qu'il va répondre en s'appuyant sur plutôt des choses anecdotiques, sur ses observations. Il y a beaucoup de jeunes, des jeunes éduqués, des gens qui ont côtoyé toutes ces idées au collège, à l'université, la pensée de l'intersectionnalité en particulier, des gens qui ont été sociabilisés à Occupy Wall Street. Donc, c'est tout à fait juste que ça a eu une influence. Et donc, il y a une conscience qui est à la fois raciale et économique. Est-ce que tout ça va déboucher sur une alliance durable, ça, on ne peut pas le savoir aujourd'hui, mais en tout cas, il s'est joué quelque chose à ce moment-là avec ces jeunes blancs éduqués, disons. En ce qui concerne le multiculturalisme, bah, ça a joué sur le côté moral plutôt que sur un côté institutionnel. Donc, ce n'est pas une mauvaise chose en soi, mais c'est secondaire dans ce qu'on observe aujourd'hui. Ça a un effet positif, mais plutôt superficiel, d'après toi. So, Tom, it's too short. You have to come back.
It's fantastic.
You have to come back. I can tell you we were all very, very happy to have you with us. Next time, maybe we finished with the virus and you come and visit us in Paris and we shall be so happy to have you with us. So in name of everybody here, I really thank you very, very warmly. Let us keep in touch. Merci
beaucoup. Thank you so much. Great afternoon. Thank you.